With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in today to the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, CSP payments to producers significantly increased for 2024. We'll take a look at that. But to start today, there's a lot going on in the cattle industry. Coming up later, Brian German has an interview on the HPAI outbreaks in dairy operations and finds out if it could happen here. But first, we start on another topic with Hunter Ehrman of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
I'm Hunter Ehrman, and today we're talking about the U.S.-EU Collaboration Platform on Agriculture. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently hosted an event to further conversations between American and European ag officials this week, and NCBA played a key role in this meeting, with NCBA Policy Division Chair and Idaho rancher Kim Brackett serving as a panelist, and NCBA Chief Counsel Mary Thomas Hart moderating a discussion. Joining us now to discuss this event is NCBA Executive Director of Government Affairs Kent Backus, along with Kim and Mary Thomas. Let's start with you, Kent. Give us some background on the Collaboration Platform on Agriculture.
So the Collaboration Platform on Agriculture was it's an endeavor between USDA and their European counterparts, DG Agri, to really try to find areas where we can work together with a focus on sustainable production. With Europeans, there's a lot of concerns over food security and also over climate. And so these are two areas where the U.S. and the EU have really tried to focus on where can we work together to share ideas on improving supply chains, on improving production methodologies and applications. So not only is it about, you know, sharing policy ideas, it's about sharing research. And then they brought the producers in for this, brought industry in to find out where do we really need to identify, like what are some key areas where we can work together. Now, keep in mind, we have some fundamental differences between the way that we use science in food production here in the United States and the Europeans' view of science, which is traditionally more subjective. And it, in many ways, it's not as robust of what we have here. Here, science is the defining factor for everything. We look at that for efficiencies. We look at that for safety. And ultimately, we do that to have the safest and most efficient food production system in the world. With Europeans, they take other factors into place, like social concerns and things that are a little more subjective in nature, harder to measure. So because of that, we have a long history where, quite frankly, our relationship has been very icy. It's been very, very difficult to have trade. So with this platform, this is really the recognition of the two governments that we need to find ways to work together as the two largest food producing economies in the world. We need to be the ones to really look at these next generation issues and find some solutions, some common ground where we can work together. NCBA has participated in multiple rounds of this collaboration effort. We first participated in December of 2022. I was in Brussels along with Jacqueline Wilson, who's one of our producers and also one of our committee chairs. And so we've been able to participate in that way. You know, in 2023, I was in Brussels again with Ethan Lane to focus specifically on sustainability and cattle production. This latest event of the Collaboration Platform of Agriculture is the first time the United States has actually hosted this. And so this was another opportunity for us to highlight all of the efficient practices we have here, to talk about our sustainability goals, and to really share a lot of the advances that we've made and try to find yet another way to work with our European counterparts.
Now, Kim, you were on a panel talking about the future of the livestock sector. Could you tell us what you discussed as a panelist?
Sure, Hunter. I talked a lot about the challenges and the opportunities that we have in the cattle industry when we're talking sustainability. I talked about some of the challenges that I feel as a producer, and it's that increased scrutiny on my production practices. And so I followed up and shared some of the production practices that we do on a ranch. I talked a lot about grazing as a tool. I talked about ecosystem services. And then I spent quite a bit of time underscoring the importance of BQA. When we're talking with the EU and they're talking animal welfare back home, we wanted to make sure they understood that we have our own animal care program here. Yes, it's voluntary, but it is definitely widely widely embraced across this country by producers, and tried to explain to them a little bit the value of creating their own science-based animal care program. And then from more of a broader industry perspective, talked about the need for increasing understanding about the efficiency portion of sustainability, how important it is that we continue to talk about efficiency and why that makes the beef supply chain sustainable. Talked about some examples on my ranch, talked about examples throughout the sectors of the beef supply chain and efficiency.
So, Kim, why do you think it's important to tell the cattle industry's sustainability story in a venue or a meeting like this?
I think the best way to answer that question is after the panel, Hunter, I had several folks from the EU come up to me and say, it sounds like what you're already doing is sustainable, so we're not sure what you're doing that's not sustainable. And so I think just letting them know what we're doing, being really transparent and helping them understand what our production practices across this country really do look like, I'm hoping it reassures them. I'm hoping that they can see a way forward for the EU based upon what we're doing here in the United States.
Now, Mary Thomas, you moderated this discussion with Kim. What did you hear from other panelists, and how did NCBA fit into that conversation?
Great question, Hunter. So in addition to getting Kim's really valuable perspective, we also heard from the U.S. dairy industry, a trade association representing livestock producers in the EU, as well as an EU animal welfare group. So it was really interesting to hear the different perspectives in the room on really where the pressure is coming from to make adjustments, to evolve as an industry. From the EU, I think we hear this a lot in the States, but it comes from the government, and it's kind of a top-down mandate from the European Union to those producers, and it may take the form of, you know, mandated practices. It may take the form of limited market access, you know, all of those things that we kind of talk about in the United States as maybe a nightmare situation. But they look at the United States and see that a lot of our pressures are kind of coming from within our own supply chains, right? So in addition to our panel today, we heard from people in the retail sector. We heard from processors. We heard from input organizations. And so, you know, I think pressures within the supply chain, recognizing that, you know, the feed industry can't meet its goals if we don't meet our goals, and our retailers can't meet their goals if we don't meet our goals. So, you know, I think that the U.S. vantage point was very focused on the reliance of, you know, one sector on another, or one stage of the supply chain on another, whereas the EU really focused on the risk and the harm associated with that kind of top-down government regulation. So really interesting to hear, I think, the pros and cons of both sides of that. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, we make a clear argument for why it's better to kind of use the carrot instead of the stick when pushing forward policies, especially when it comes to sustainability.
Mary Thomas, could you sort of compare and contrast a bit more the relationship between European producers and their government versus American producers and ours?
I'm not sure that it's any more or less contentious in the EU or in the United States. I think that all, you know, rural Europeans, rural Americans feel the same way about, you know, the existence of federal government and the size of federal government and how much it should have control over our day-to-day lives. But I think you've seen that carried out to a greater extent in the European Union, right? So anything from regulations that impact their everyday production practices all the way, you know, if we're looking at current proposals like their deforestation regulations and carbon border adjustments that could even impact our ability in the United States to produce products that can make it into the European Union market, they just have a much more aggressive federal government. Here, I think, you know, the federal government hears and understands our concerns, and we really do focus on maintaining a cooperative federalism approach, right? Kind of maintaining the balance between state and federal government. And I think that helps keep producers happy. It keeps policies localized and effective.
And just to add to that, I think it's also important for people to understand, when you look at European policies, these are really set in many ways without a lot of input from stakeholders. So you have a lot of regulatory designs. You have things like the Green Deal, which are widely, they have a wide impact on all of agricultural production, where they set these idealistic goals and then try to find science or try to find some other way to kind of backfill and justify that. The problem is when you have that kind of top-down edict, that is given to these producers. These producers can't comply with those standards. When you have smaller operations all across Europe, that they have to make these adjustments. They have to implement all of these new regulatory standards on, you know, where they can grow certain crops, what kind of livestock they can produce, what kind of standards they have to be produced under. They have to do all of that without any real aid in that transition. So if you're going to continue to farm, then you have to front the cost to make all these changes to come into compliance. It's not like you can, you know, go to a bank and take out a loan and do these things. But in order for you to receive your payment, your subsidy at the end of the year, you have to show that you've come into compliance with all of these things. So that has led to a significant consolidation within all aspects of agricultural production across Europe. It's led to mass exodus of farmers, and they really do have some food security issues, and they have a lot of succession issues as well. So that mindset that European producers are bringing to the table, you know, they're looking for opportunities like this collaboration platform on agriculture, to have that discussion with other producers and to get those ideas and to look for solutions and ways to actually continue to have sustainable production. Because it's not just about environmental sustainability, it's about economic sustainability. And if you look at the European system as it is, that's their biggest vulnerability. Whereas here in the United States, we're looking for opportunities to, you know, to drive more producer profitability, to use these different production practices we use to differentiate our products and to find other ways to be competitive. So I think going forward, that's going to be an important discussion that we have is, yes, where can we work together and try to achieve some common goals on climate, on, you know, improving animal care. But also, I think the Europeans are looking at this and saying, how can we be more like the Americans and have more of this, you know, economic sustainability be a stronger part of this narrative?
Kent, I know NCBA has invested a great deal in building relationships with European ag officials. Tell us a little bit more about how these relationships came into play for today's event.
So at events like this, you know, it really is a room full of bureaucrats and a lot of people, not only from Brussels, but, you know, here in the United States as well. That's one of the things that NCBA does is we try to identify who those people are, who their decision makers are, how they work with our decision makers. And then that gives us an opportunity to kind of correct the misinformation and correct the narrative about U.S. production practices. So that's one of the things that we work on here is we try to build those relationships so that it's not just a conversation that happens at these kind of events, but it's something that happens on a regular basis. So that way, you know, they can see past the misinformation and know who the legitimate sources of information are when it comes to U.S. livestock production. And that's really what NCBA brings to the table, is the fact that we have those relationships. We've invested and built those relationships, and it takes a lot of time to do that. But when you can build trust with someone who has really been an adversary in many ways, then it starts not to be so adversarial, and you really have more productive conversations. And, you know, that's part of the long-term investment we have in building those relationships. And that's really one of the things that sets NCBA apart from everybody else.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen, and we will be back in just a moment. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is accepting applications for the Conservation Stewardship Program through April 26th. Assistant State Conservationist with NRCS, Brandon Bates, highlighted a notable change for this year's program.
We did raise the minimal annual payment for our contracts from $1,500 to $4,000 annually. And those yearly payments are calculated based upon the planned activities they're doing. And of course, some, again, the stewardship of what they're already doing out on the property, plus the new enhancements they're doing. But again, this with this new change, it's automatically they're going to get at least $4,000 a year in the CSP program, regardless of size of farm, operation, and et cetera. As long as they're eligible as an individual and the land is eligible, the minimum payment is $4,000 a year.
Vesteron Corporation and Simplot Grower Solutions have entered into a partnership to expand the distribution of Vesteron's biocontrols for specialty crops. Simplot's extensive network of over 40,000 customers in the U.S. and Canada will facilitate the wider availability of Vesteron's products. This collaboration not only broadens Vesteron's reach, but also enriches Simplot's product portfolio. The partnership emphasizes sustainable agriculture practices, aligning with the industry shift towards environmentally friendly solutions. Both companies express commitment to supporting farmers with innovative tools for pest management. By leveraging Simplot's distribution infrastructure and Vesteron's cutting-edge technologies, the collaboration aims to drive adoption of sustainable crop protection solutions addressing evolving challenges in modern agriculture. Undersecretary Alexis Taylor will lead a U.S. Department of Agriculture trade mission to New Delhi, India in the coming weeks. The delegation includes 47 businesses and 11 State Departments of Agriculture representatives aiming to tap into India's growing economy as the world's fifth largest. Taylor highlights India's rising middle class who are already familiar with American food products, presenting an opportunity for U.S. producers. Over the past 2 years, U.S. ag exports to India have grown by 11%. USDA aims to expand market access for American producers, leveraging recent tariff reductions on various products. The trade mission will take place April 22nd through the 25th and includes business meetings, site visits, and market briefings to strengthen trade links and observe consumer food trends. This initiative aligns with USDA's commitment to broaden ag business trade benefits for American producers. After a recent determination from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Hass avocados from Guatemala could soon be entering the U.S. market. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has completed a pest risk analysis for importing fresh avocados from Guatemala. APHIS concluded that designated phytosanitary measures can mitigate the risks of introducing pests into the United States. This assessment allows Guatemalan avocados to advance to a public comment period for market access. APHIS proposes a systems approach for importation, requiring pest-free production areas and traceability measures. Guatemala's National Plant Protection Organization will oversee implementation. Currently, Mexico dominates the U.S. avocado market with a 90% share, followed by Peru. The public has until May 28th to review and comment on the APHIS documents. The North American Meat Institute Scholarship Foundation is now accepting applications for scholarship opportunities for undergraduate students pursuing degrees in animal, meat, food sciences, and culinary arts. The Meat Foundation will be awarding one $10,000 Barry Carpenter Scholarship along with several $5,000 scholarships. The foundation's overseen by a dedicated group of board members that volunteer their time and efforts and work in close collaboration with volunteers on the Scholarship Selection Committee. Scholarships are merit-based and presented annually to accomplished students pursuing education that will lead to a career in the meat industry. The deadline to apply for scholarships for the 2024-2025 academic year is Friday, May 31st. Interested students are encouraged to review the eligibility and rules before beginning the application form. More information about the scholarship opportunities is available at meetscholars.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Consumers last month paid more for shelter and gasoline, but not for food. Gary Crawford has more in today's This Land of Ours report.
The government's Consumer Price Index report for March is getting a lot of serious attention right now because it shows an unexpectedly high rate of annual inflation, 3.5%, in the general economy. However, experts say you can't blame that on food prices. In fact,
food at home or grocery prices were actually flat in March.
No increase at all. This from Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer. She says that during March, of the 15 major food categories she tracks, prices went up for 9, down for 6.
For the most part, we saw prices increase for categories across the meats, poultry, and fish categories. Prices declined for dairy products, for fats and oils, sugar and sweets, cereals and bakery products, and for fresh fruits and fresh vegetables,
leaving overall grocery store food prices up from this time a year ago, but by only 1.2%. Oh, but Schweitzer says some foods are selling for less than a year ago, namely eggs, dairy products, fish, and seafood. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A new Bayer-led coalition focuses on access to crop protection tools. Michael Klimitz shares more.
Recently, grower and industry groups from across the country have joined together to support a new coalition, the Modern Ag Alliance. Jess Christensen, head of crop science and sustainability communications for Bayer, explains the effort.
The Modern Ag Alliance is a new coalition of more than 65 diverse agriculture organizations led by Bayer that have joined together to protect American farmers' access to critical crop protection tools they need to ensure a robust and affordable food supply.
The Alliance will collaborate with policymakers to ensure continued access to crop protection tools.
Farmers need these critical crop protection innovations now more than ever, and certainly to ensure the continued long-term availability of products like glyphosate. The Alliance helps advance this important initiative by working alongside federal and state policymakers to voice its support for legislative solutions that ensure consistency in labeling for the continued domestic availability of farming innovations.
The goal is to ensure regulation follows scientific findings.
Simply put, it means that the Modern Ag Alliance is working with agricultural partners and policymakers across the country to reinforce the importance of science-based regulation. Specifically, the need to ensure that any pesticide registered with the EPA and sold under a label consistent with the EPA's own determinations is sufficient to satisfy requirements for health and safety warnings.
Christensen says current and new innovations in crop protection are critical for the future success of farmers.
Safe, effective crop protection tools are essential to modern agriculture, and so is ensuring a framework that supports farmers' predictable access to these products. For 50 years, glyphosate, the most widely used U.S. herbicide, has served as farmers' top defense against invasive weeds that threaten crop yields while helping protect Americans' wallets with food inflation at a 30-year high. These tools are also essential for farmers looking to adopt and implement new regenerative agricultural practices designed to reduce the overall environmental impact of farming. Practices like no-till and planting cover crops deliver key benefits such as increased soil health and reduced erosion while improving water infiltration to the soil.
Organizations and farmers interested in learning more can do so online.
On behalf of the Modern Ag Alliance, we thank the organizations who have already stood up and made their voices heard by joining. And we want to welcome other organizations who are looking to be a part of this. Organizations and farmers can find more information by visiting controlweedsnotfarming.com. And I know it's the middle of the season, so everybody's busy. But once there, it'll only take a couple minutes, we encourage folks to send a letter to their elected officials, letting them know that you support these important tools.
That was Jess Christensen, head of crop science and sustainability communications for Bayer. For more information on the Modern Ag Alliance, visit controlweedsnotfarming.com. Michael Clements reporting.
Recently announced, the latest in a series of offerings to assist rural residents and communities in dealing with farm stress and rural mental health challenges and stigmas. Rod Bain reports.
Efforts continue to expand in the realm of addressing mental health issues and eliminating mental health stigmas in rural America. Among those leading the way, a variety of agricultural and rural-oriented organizations, private businesses, and nonprofit groups. There was the recent announcement of
free access to counseling for farmers and ranchers and those in rural America.
Terry Moore is with the American Farm Bureau Federation, one of several partners within the Farm Family Wellness Alliance. Their new platform, found at www.farmfoundation.org/resources, provides anonymous online mental health and well-being services, and as important, points to local resources in rural communities. She acknowledges,
one of the challenges in the mental health arena is that often we have national hotlines, but those counselors may not understand rural America. Life is very different in rural America, and so the psychology of helping someone in crisis in rural America is different. And that, too, is part of what we have been working to achieve.
Another partner in the Farm Family Wellness Alliance, the National Farmers Union. Rob LaRue of NFU says in addition to resources, partnership among farm groups can also provide encouragement to those seeking rural mental health resources.
Issues like this, making sure that we're reaching out to help our neighbors, that's the rural way, that's the farmer way, and that we're doing it around issues so important like farm stress and mental health, I think is a good sign and hopefully will continue to improve conditions out there.
The nonprofit organization Rural Minds recently joined forces with the National Grange to offer the Rural Mental Health Resilience Program. found at www.ruralminds.org. Judy Lux of Rural Minds says it offers several free resources.
It's everything from friend or family member who might be struggling. How can you have that conversation with them, not be afraid to have that conversation with them, to ways that you can hold an event. So, for example, a church or an organization in a community would like to raise awareness about mental health. There's a toolkit for how to hold an event and raise awareness within those communities. So it's very much a grassroots effort.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
There were a few changes made by the USDA in some of its major yearly reports. David Geiger has the details.
There are some program changes at the National Agricultural Statistics Service after a five-year review of the 400 individual reports it is responsible for. After the Census of Agriculture is released, the agency responsible for collecting and presenting farm data from around the country takes a look at that information to ensure estimating programs adapt to reflect the changes in agriculture. Greg Tayson, the director of the Upper Midwest Regional Office with NAS, says changes were minimal in his area, especially with crops. But in livestock, it does impact lower production states. Many were placed into a broad all-other category like the final hogs and pigs report.
The December report will be just like the other quarters, where we'll publish 16 states individually, and the 34 states, even in December, we will be part of the other state total. And that's kind of consistent. We've made similar changes like that for some of the other livestock commodities as well.
Likewise, the number of published states for cattle will drop from 50 to 31. Milk will drop to 33 states. Three states will be removed from the chicken and eggs report, 19 removed from honey, two from meat goats, and one state from milk goats. Tayson says the reason for changing every 5 years is simple.
Our programs are taxpayer funded, and so we're trying to use the resources that are provided to our agency in the best way possible.
Ultimately, the reports rely on voluntary participation in filling out surveys.
That's another thing we run into. If we can't get enough responses, or the other aspect of it is we have to keep information confidential. And so sometimes that affects our ability to publish a particular state.
You can find the changes yourself by going online and searching NAS Program Review. I'm David Geiger reporting.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just want to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's featured interview.
We're joined by CEO of Western United Dairies, Anya Radabaugh, this morning to talk about the outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza that's been impacting dairy cows in several other states and the efforts that California is taking to help prevent infection. But first, Anya, let's go over what this disease is and how it's made its way to becoming a concern for dairies.
So avian influenza is not a new disease. It is an endemic disease to North America. It travels via migrating bird from north to south in the winter and then from south to north in the spring, summer, and fall. And so it follows the path of Aleutian geese, of bald eagles, of a number of other waterfowl that tend to fly south for the winter. And so Texas, unfortunately, was the epicenter of a massive amount of migrating birds. And it's not a new disease amongst birds. It's highly communicable to other species of bird. We've often seen animals like cats and goats sometimes be affected. But what is new with highly pathogenic avian influenza is its transmissibility to dairy cattle. And what we've seen in 2024 is really this new ability to attach the virus to animals that are lactating. And that, or a mammary gland, has a very strong marker right now to attach itself to animals that have mammary glands and are heavily lactating, which is not good news for dairy farmers. And so we have dozens and dozens of manuals on the farm to protect against biosecurity. It's often good practice to follow standard PPE and standard biosecurity procedures to avoid things like hoof and mouth disease, mad cow. Like, these are very well documented. You know, here are the steps you take to avoid that on a daily. You're not going to find a manual that includes avian influenza. And so the dairy industry has had to really react. We've had to bring in a team of scientists from FDA, CDC, OSHA. The list goes on in terms of the amount of virologists that are looking at this, because it is a very substantial mutation. And unfortunately, about 10 days ago, we were able to identify and isolate the fact that it is spreading from cow to cow. That was really where California dairy farmers sat up and said, we have to stop this from coming into California, because the economic impacts, unfortunately, for those poor herds that have been affected in Texas and Michigan have been horrific. And so we'll talk a little bit about how the virus presents itself in dairy cattle. But before I go any further, I know this is an ag podcast, but anybody that might be listening needs to understand that the consumption of beef and dairy products are 100% safe for consumers, because pasteurization and proper meat handling has always been effective at killing viruses. And so that's something I'd like to get out right away. Consuming dairy products that are pasteurized are 100% safe. So that said, the virus is presenting itself in a marked drop in rumination and a decreased milk production capacity. The first thing that the animal presents is, you know, just a slower, it's called rumen hypermotility, which just means that their rumen is not able to break down as many gases. A dairy farmer, this is not unusual for a farmer to do, is to listen to the cow's tummy. But a veterinarian, your herd veterinarian, will know exactly what this means. And that's resulting in a decline in feed intake, which then within hours results in a decline in milk production. And so those cows are often flagged right away in the milking barn and pulled off the line for better analysis and put into the sick pen. Changes in milk, the milk will often start to resemble like a yellowish, brownish, like almost colostrum type of consistency. And it really is widespread into all four quarters. And so from there, other symptoms that cows are showing in this moment, there's kind of a drier, tackier manure, which kind of makes sense with the loss of rumen motility. And then they are demonstrating respiratory symptoms. So kind of a very clear nasal discharge has been very prominent in the herds that are affected. And herds are reporting fevers up to 107 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's moderately elevated. And certainly, you know, the cow does not feel good. And so as we isolate these cows into the sick pen, dairy farmers are seeing an incubation period somewhere between 10 and 14 days. And this is particularly important if you are moving young stock from state to state, but you really need to make sure that your young stock, which can harbor the disease, they may not demonstrate it because, like I said, if they're not lactating, the odds of them actually presenting symptoms is pretty small. So you want to make sure that they are well placed away from your milking herd on your dairy farm. And the peak pulls seem to be between somewhere between 3 and 7 days of the outbreak. And herds are reporting pulling between 10 and 20% of their herd and putting them in the hospital pen. So that's pretty damaging. And what we see is that most cows are starting to come back onto feed within a few days and maybe recovering after 30 to 45 days. There's not a high mortality associated with this virus, but what we are seeing is that the animals that are in their fourth and fifth lactation are not often recovering to their full production capacity, and they are being culled, which is putting a lot of pressure on the young stock and the springer stock. And this is why California farmers sat up in their beds at night and said, wait a minute, I don't have enough replacements to replace 10 or 20% of my herd. Which is a problem all across the country. People are operating on really razor-thin margins, so they're just not keeping huge replacement herd stock around. So the economics of this are pretty damaging. Between 4 and 20 pounds per cow is kind of like the average herd level that's been seen in terms of milk production drops. And so the culling is occurring in a variety of ways. Usually the first culls, meaning cows go to beef or are separated entirely, happens within the first or secondary infection. And then if after 35, 40 or 60 days, she's not coming back to full production, she's basically eligible for a cull. So there's not a lot of treatment if your herd gets impacted by this. There are some palliative kind of supportive care things you can give the animal to make her more comfortable. But unfortunately, it looks like we're just having to let the virus run its course. And because there's that metabolic disruption, it's unknown at this point what the long-term reproduction effects are going to be. But because of that disruption, it's very likely that there will be some challenges in the future.
And just one thing I think is worth mentioning again is that even though there's that story out about a human case, that's not related to consumption of meat and dairy products. Those products continue to be safe to consume, correct?
That is 100% correct. And that's something that, unfortunately, for the highly sensitive COVID post-pandemic world, has been hideously misreported. That dairy worker, unfortunately, came into contact with secretions from a sick animal and did not use PPE and rubbed his own eyes. And so he presented conjunctivitis or pink eye directly related to HPAI. But to your point, that it was not from the consumption of dairy products.
Continuing our conversation about what's known as bovine-associated influenza and the issue it's creating in other states with the CEO of Western United Dairies, Anya Radabaugh. And now, Anya, as of April 10th, there have not been any confirmed cases in California, but there is still concern. So what are some of the efforts to try and keep it that way?
So it's important to point out that any herd movement across state lines in California has always included something called a certificate of veterinary inspection. And so any animals, whether they be beef, calves, dairy springers, are always accompanied with this veterinary inspection piece. And so what we did is we asked the state veterinarian to put in some additional precautions that she felt after consulting with teams of her veterinarians and, of course, her APHIS border agents, because, you know, those little fabulous border agents that you go through when you go from state to state, or if you've had a weekend partying in Vegas, you know, you get stuck on the I-15 at the CDFA inspection station. This is exactly what those inspection stations are for, this moment. And so what the state veterinarian and the CDFA have decided to do is identify on the certificate of veterinary inspection that these animals are not originating from a premise with a confirmed detection of bovine. It's called bovine-associated highly pathogenic avian influenza. It's a long name. Or anything that is under suspicion or suspect the premise to be possibly infected with avian influenza. So that added statement also increased, it shortened the time that is allowed between a veterinary inspection and the movement. So that has to be done within 24 hours of moving them. And again, the Ag Border Inspections, this order was given on the 5th of April. So it is likely that every single border station right now at the Ag Border has been made safe and that those border inspectors are up to code and standard. And they will be stopping people and fining people $1,000 per head per day if there is any high-risk movement of cattle. I'd like to point out for trade purposes, our dairy industry is just as dependent on a healthy beef sector as the beef sector is on the dairy industry. So for trade purposes, it's important to be clear that we are not stopping imports of cattle. Rather, we are enforcing the existing import prohibition on bringing diseased cattle into California. And the border agents have been trained up on it now. You know, you always want to make sure that they're looking at the veterinary inspections, but right now, they've been really geared up to look at that, I think, a lot more closely. And I think it definitely is looking more and more like cow-to-cow transmission is the primary mechanical spread associated with dairy cows. So it really starts at the restrictions around the cattle. And so it's really important. Again, you mentioned it once. I've mentioned it now. Now we'll say it a third time, that heat treatment kills the virus. And so even if there are affected herds, wherever they are in the United States, if they're not pulled off the line, pasteurization kills the virus.
So a lot of enforcement efforts being bolstered in a way, and I'm assuming this will continue to progress moving forward as more information becomes available and just more is known about the issue?
Yeah, this situation is evolving and changing, and I think that it's very difficult as a farmer to have some patience while the, you know, the bigwig scientists work their magic, but we don't know how it's spread yet. You know, like, what is the origin of this virus? We strongly suspect it comes from migrating birds, but is it the feed? Is it the bird feces? Is it the birds bathing in the water? These are all questions that have not been answered yet, and so guidance and directives will definitely be changing every single week as the scientists know more. For example, like, do we need to quarantine off our commodity barns? Because the birds certainly enjoy their bird buffet in there, you know, eating eating all our delicious products. It's just, you know, if you've ever seen, especially this time of year, it is literally a bird smorgasbord on every single one of our dairies. So the dairy farmers in California are actively harboring and protecting the tricolored blackbird, which is an endangered species. It is not a known carrier of highly pathogenic avian influenza, but Aleutian geese are, bald eagles are. And so I would also add that sometimes testing is random. If you don't get a bird that's turned in to the CDC or the veterinarians, you know, you don't know how these animals are dying. And so you're only testing where you can. Sometimes there's randomized wild trials, meaning they'll go out and catch some birds and test them for avian influenza. So, but this is why there's a lot of questions around the transmission. We know that once the herd catches it, it can go from cow to cow. And that's why we're trying to do what we can to separate the young stock, as it seems to only present itself in the lactating animals. So I think that, you know, people want to visit our website, wudairies.com. We have up-to-date information on there. Everything that's been published every day is put on our website. So if you wanted to drive yourself crazy and try to read all the work that the CDC and the FDA is doing on this, I certainly welcome you to do that. You know, I am very unoptimistic about social media. Twitter has proven itself to be an absolute dumpster fire on this. I don't know what I was expecting. There are a lot of misassociations with this outbreak being something that is pandemic status. Again, recall that avian influenza is endemic. It happens every single year. And so it's really important to emphasize that milk and meat are safe if they are pasteurized and properly cooked. And it's not like something that, again, that case that happened, you mentioned in Texas with the dairy worker, contracting conjunctivitis was not spread to the consumption of products. He came into contact with an infected animal. So we're working on that. There is a new article that was released by the Telegraph from Europe alleging that animal carcasses and chicken feces are being fed to cows and pigs. That is 100% not the case. We have very strict protocols in place, especially in California, to prevent the spread of a mad cow disease. So those things are not even true, right? So these are moments where I previously would have stayed out of the fray. I'm getting involved now, trying to clarify that record because we need people to feel confident about their food supply. This is not another pandemic. And right now, we're pathogen-free here in California, and we're hoping to stay that way.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com.